Hello and welcome to the first Ipsos UK Pride podcast. We are doing this podcast for LGBTQ plus History Month. And as it's 2024, we're also celebrating 10 years of equal marriage in the UK. My name's Eileen Irvin. I'm co-chair of the Ipsos Pride Network in the UK. And I'm an associate director in our public affairs team. And I'm joined by some other members of the Pride Committee, who will now introduce themselves.
I'm Zach Foreman. I'm a research executive in the customer experience team at Ipsos, and I've been on the Pride Committee for about nearly 2 years now since I joined.
Hi, I'm Chris Hudgings. I'm the deputy head of our creative excellence team. Also been on the Pride Network for around two and a half years since I joined, and am fellow co-chair with Eileen.
And I'm Jess Rage. I am an associate director within our channel performance team, which is mystery shopping. And I've been on the committee since I first joined as well, so about 2.5 years now.
Fantastic. So as said, we're going to focus today talking about 10 years of equal marriage in England and Wales. Zach, I know you've been looking at some of our polling data. How things have changed over that time.
Yeah, so before researching this, I did have sort of an idea, you know, growing up, that opinions around gay marriage and LGBT equality did shift quite a bit from the latter half of the 20th century, but I didn't realise how much things actually transformed. So a great example of this was an Ipsos article from 2014, where I think around in 1975, the disagreement with gay marriage was around little over 50%, and the don't knows was quite a big section as well. So it was only around in the low tens of people agreeing with gay marriage, which makes sense with the climate at the time. And then you have to 2014, which I think is about 40 so years, which isn't too much of a big gap in for social issues, but the agreement went from about 13% to nearly 70%, which is amazing. And other polling data also backs this up. You have data from the British Social Attitudes Survey that they have this every year, and recently it showed how the transformation in opinions around gay marriage and just gay equality in general really shot up too. So this is backed up by multiple polling methods. I would say that you could say gay marriage, opinions around gay marriage liberalising is part of a current trend of liberalisation in society, but I think gay marriage is unique in the sense that the favourability of gay marriage or agreement with it has gone up amongst all age groups. So it's not like people, I guess, less liberal generations are being aged out by younger generation, more liberal ones. It's just all across the board we're seeing opinions about gay marriage become much more positive. And it's also not to do so much with religion. So all religious all religious groups actually have higher agreement rates with marriage equality than they did years ago. So yeah, I think it's just a very interesting social phenomena. And I think it can also be chalked up to media representation. So I know, Chris, you mentioned yesterday actually that in EastEnders they recently had a gay wedding, and you wouldn't see this even like 15, 20 years ago, you know? So I think more media representation has really helped shoot, you know, the numbers up for marriage equality. And I think it's really interesting to hear, Eileen, how that public opinion was then transferred over into the legal realm as well.
Yeah, I think we've been kind of looking into the sort of history side of it, and it, when you talk about that kind of drastic shift over even just the last sort of 40 years, it's that's less than someone's lifetime, and it's still changed so drastically. So I think it's only in 1967 that homosexuality was legalized in England and Wales. Then not till 1982 in Northern Ireland, not till 1980 in Scotland, 1983 in Guernsey, 1990 in Jersey. You're talking very late on in the 20th century that these laws were still on the books. within the UK and kind of its dependencies. And it, the age of consent was still not the same. So it was 21 for gay men. It was 16 for heterosexual couples. And for lesbians, it did not exist. Until they were all equalised at 16, there was none, which is also appalling. But things changed so rapidly because you have, you know, you see the age of consent being lowered to 18 and 16 in 1994, and then Section 28, which some people may know, this Section 28 of the Local Government Act, which prohibited local governments from intentionally promoting homosexuality or promoting the teaching of homosexuality as a pretended family relationship, which had been on the books since 1988. That was repealed in Scotland in 2000 and not in England and Wales until 2003. That was still on the books. That was still people's lived experience. And then you very quickly get the equalisation of the age of consent at 16 in 2001. In 2002, the introduction of equal rights to adoption for same-sex couples. Only a year later, civil partnerships and the Gender Recognition Act in 2004, the Equality Act in 2006. And other laws around fertility rights and surrogacy rights coming in 2008 and 2010. And by 2013, marriage in England and Wales extended to Scotland in 2014 and then extended to Northern Ireland in 2020. But it's quite a substantial shift in just a few years to go from it's on the books that local authorities can't promote homosexuality as a pretended family relationship to, and now you can have marriage and adoption and fertility rights. It is a relatively short space of time for so many legal things to have changed, as well as the public attitudes. And it's hard to say which is coming first, whether it's the public attitudes coming first and shaping the law, or whether it's the law coming first and shaping the public attitudes, or whether it's that combination of the two.
I think it's a combination of the two, because you needed that public support to for politicians to feel able to go on a limb when it wasn't that popular among some people to actually fight for gay marriage.
Because you're right in terms of, you need, in order for the government to do anything, they need to make sure that they've got backing, and they're not going to change anything. Well, they're not going to change anything for the sake of doing it, as you say. But having the backing of the public is going to be, you know, really significant in terms of them changing any laws.
I think there's elements of popular culture as well, like the two kind of affecting each other, like high profile celebrity marriages, high profile celebrities being out, it all starts to feed into popular culture. The kind of becomes a virtuous circle.
And also just knowing more real people in your life who are coming out and getting married and all of that, I think that also can help people realise that it's not so scary. Some of my family are Catholic, but I always said they were the type of Catholics where, as long as there's a baby, we don't really care how it got there. So my nana, when her step-granddaughter and her wife had a baby, she was so overjoyed because she was just like, well, they got married and they had a baby. And sure, they're both women, but they got married and they had a baby. And that's all I really wanted for them, because that's what will bring them happiness. And I think, I don't know that she would have had that attitude before it was the people that she loved around her. But when it was, she absolutely did. And I think I think that exposure to people in your life makes such a big difference. And legal things, meaning that people felt they were able to come out and did have that legal support, probably also helped drive some of that. Although we are talking about kind of History Month, I think we also want to talk about what this meant for our personal history and our personal relationship with equal marriage. So Chris, do you want to talk a little bit about your experiences?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's really interesting listening back to how much has changed and in policy terms and public perception terms in such a short time. In preparation for today, I was reflecting a lot, and I should give my kind of situation. So I am in my late 40s, approaching my 50s. I have been with my partner, Ryan, for about 18 years now. We aren't married, but we are engaged. We have been engaged for about 7 or 8 years and are planning to get married. And it's interesting just reflecting back, like in my childhood, you had certain expectations, get married, have a house, have children, all by the time you're 25, then you realize that none of that is realistic in real life. But and then when I started to come to terms with my sexuality, I just automatically assumed that getting married wouldn't be an option. And then when it became an option, it's a really interesting thing to think about, not for any kind of religious reasons or necessarily any legal reasons either, but more something that I always kind of thought would be part of my future, then thought couldn't be anymore, suddenly is on the table and it's an option again. And also something that you see, having kind of grown up hiding part of your identity, suddenly you can put that out there and you can celebrate it in the same way that you see heterosexual couples celebrating their relationship. And so that's really interesting. But one of the things that Ryan and myself have been thinking about is, how do we then get married? And like, what parts of a, in inverted commas, traditional marriage do we want? And what bits don't we want? We want the cake. That is a given. We definitely want the cake, but like, what else do we want? Do we want the first dance? Do we want everyone stood around watching us? Do we want a breakfast? Do we want this? But so actually thinking about how we can take the concept of marriage that has for a while been open to us again, and think about how we can do that in a way that feels authentic to us, as part of the reason, along with COVID, is part of the reason why we've been engaged for so long and haven't actually worked out what we're going to do.
I am married. I got married in October 2019. And I guess it's a kind of a similar thing, kind of from what Chris was saying. I going back to what you're saying, I was brought up in a very Catholic household, and I, Catholic parents, it was you go to church, and my parents were never prejudiced, but it was always that kind of looming thing. So it took me a long time to come to terms or to realise my sexuality. I didn't come out until I was 29. And which is, you know, in the grand scheme of things, quite late. And I spent a lot of my 20s really kind of not trying, searching myself for myself, let's say. And I think that when I met my wife, Katie, we met and it moved very quickly, which I know there is the jokes around lesbians moving very quickly. And, you know, there is some truth to that. And we knew we wanted to get married. We knew it wasn't really a question in terms of a civil partnership or not. We wanted a marriage. We knew instantly that we did. And it was almost that, well, why not? Why can't we have the big wedding? And it wasn't a church wedding, of course, but it was still the white wedding that we had. And we got married like after we'd only been together 2 years when we got married. And a lot of that was around, as I said, we knew we wanted to get married, but we also wanted to start a family. And there's a lot of kind of legal rights around same-sex couples having a family. And we wanted to go down the IVF route, which in order to automatically get both names on the birth certificate, you have to be married or in a civil partnership at the point of conception. So when you start the treatment, you have to be in that bond. So we kind of said, well, we know we want to start a family, we know we want to do these things, why wait? Let's just do it and get married. And we had no pushback from anyone at all. We had a couple of funny little interactions in the general wedding world, where I think it was never prejudice. It was never anyone kind of being like, oh, it's a gay wedding. It was more assumptions. And a lot of places were very good when we kind of went and did our separate wedding dress shopping, and they'd always say to me, oh, what does your partner do? And they never kind of used gender when they were talking about my fiance. Like, fiance is a good general term, isn't it? So they use that a lot. But there were situations at this one wedding fair that we went to where the assumption was two women at a wedding fair together is that they are friends and one of them's getting married. And they were very confused when we said we were getting married on the same day. They were very confused. But I think that all of that will shift and change as well. And I think it's really interesting what we were saying about kind of like the generational things, because I've got this vivid memory before Casey and I got engaged and got married, when my nephew, who's now 10, when he was a toddler, he turned around to my sister completely innocently and just said to her, "Mummy, when two men get married, who gets to wear the dress?" And that was his question. That was his question. It wasn't about anything else. That was what his question was. And it just feels so lovely that that's the message that children nowadays are having, not the why would a man marry a man, or it wasn't even a if, it was when two men get married.
I also love it was who gets to wear the dress.
Yeah.
You know, right? Because that's the fight you have. The dress is so much nicer. It is that thinking back of how different things even were when we were growing up, and what people are growing up with now is so different. I remember, because I'm bisexual, and I remember coming to terms with that as a teenager, and there being this thing of who I fall in love with is going to determine so much about what I'm able to do with my life. And it's hard enough to find someone who you love, like, without that also being, and who loves you back, rather than also thinking, and then if I fall in love with this person, then I can do this. But if I fall in love with this person, it has to be like this. And that was just such an odd thing to have those barriers, rather than just being, I'm in love with someone, they're in love with me, and we want to spend our lives together, and we want to do that in the way that makes sense for us. And I also had family friends growing up who, unfortunately, they're partner died of cancer, and because they were a same-sex couple, they were not able to get married, and because the house was in the partner who had died's name, it went to their family, and their family did not approve of their girlfriend, and they were homeless, and they had to find somewhere to live because there was no legal recourse for their partner to say, no, this is my person, and this is who I want to look after when I'm gone. Regardless of the fact that they'd cared for them through cancer, regardless of any of that. And I think there's wonderful, lovely things about marriage and being able to celebrate who we are and celebrate our relationships. But there's also really practical things of, you know, making sure you've got things in place for when you die, and when you're sick, and when things go wrong, that there are structures in place to support you. And those can really help.
And I think it's really interesting because there are things that I didn't even think about when I was getting married and I was planning the wedding and having my wedding day, because because everybody was so accommodating, and nobody batted an eyelid, nobody even questioned anything. I kind of, not that I took it for granted, but it was after my wedding day, my cousin came and said to me, and she's got three little girls, and she said, oh, thank you for letting them be part of your day. And I was like, what do you mean? Like, of course. They're like, it's just for them to see at such a young age, to see this and to be part of this, and for them to know like how lovely and how there's so much love and everything. It was kind of, I hadn't even really kind of thought about it like that, in terms of that we are setting the right example and doing those things for the younger generations as well.
Yeah, and I think one of the things I've been struck by in the time that we have been engaged is there is a lot of excitement around a gay wedding. People are like, oh, I've never been to a gay wedding before.
I've never been to a gay wedding.
It puts a lot of pressure on. So I've not been to one. I'm not sure what to expect. But there's a lot of outpouring of love and support and excitement, which is nice.
Just shows how much it's changed. You know, can you imagine this level of support 20 years ago? Also, I'm coming from it from a different perspective because coming of age, I was around when gay marriage was actually legalized. So even though I dealt with homophobia growing up, it was nowhere near the same as for other LGBT people. But I think gay marriage really signified that it was sort of the final nail in the coffin of homophobia. Finally, you know, at least gay, lesbian, and bisexual people are equal under law. And yeah, I think that's the most important thing. Obviously, you still have homophobia, but it's enshrined in law. It's not acceptable. We are equal.
Yeah, and I think one of the funny things that I saw is, like, you know, one of these like gifs that they post around Instagram on this time of the year that basically says, if you are against gay marriage, don't marry a gay person. And it's like that. It's as simple as that.
It's funny looking back at the arguments about it. Like, oh, it's a slippery slope. It's Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve, etc. They just sound so preposterous.
I had that growing up. I remember vividly being like in the Catholic Church and being at a wedding, someone else's wedding, and the priest actually saying that as part of the wedding speech, that he was there and he basically said to them, I'm so grateful that, you know, we have, you know, like Claire and Dave rather than Dave and Steve, actually said that in the wedding. So that was my childhood growing up. It's really sad.
Because I say, it's not the most horrific as it is, it's also not a very romantic wedding speech.
You wouldn't want that, would you? The priest saying that in the middle of your wedding. No, you wouldn't. I hope they complained.
There was a bit of a cultural war obsession in the early to mid 2010s, wasn't it? You know, for straight people, it shouldn't be an issue at all, but it was. It was used as a cultural wedge issue back then, so which it's not now.
I think civil partnerships opened a door that meant that gay marriage, that equal marriage, didn't seem as scary when it came in. It was such a shift. It was also a shift that, you know, that was brought in by a Conservative government, with the previous Conservative government having introduced Section 28. You know, it was a real marker that this was a political topic that had moved away from being a party political issue. It was a kind of across the board issue. And we were also talking about the way equal marriage was brought in, also introduced for the first time the ability to switch between a civil partnership and a marriage. And that also made a real difference to trans people who prior to that hadn't been able to get a gender recognition certificate while staying in a marriage or staying in a civil partnership, because it was not possible to be in those where the parties had changed sex. And so people were having to get divorced in order to get their gender recognition certificate, which is such a ridiculous thing to have been in a situation. But that got brought in then under the equal marriage legislation, and it also then opened up those opportunities for trans people to just be able to stay in the relationship they were in while embracing the identity that they are and having that legally recognised.
I think it just shows how marriage equality like transcends just, you know, LGB people.
Before we finish, I guess we decided that it might be helpful to finish with kind of one takeaway that you would like the people listening to think about in terms of marriage. And I think mine would be, it's a wonderful celebration, but it's also, there are real practical benefits. And I know some people feel like, you know, as queer people, we should be throwing off the shackles of previous stereotypes and not necessarily following the same traditions that heterosexual couples have. But it's nice to have the option, and it's nice to be able to have those legal benefits if you can have them. So it's worth thinking about that, as well as the decisions that are right for you.
I wanted to say, just closing remarks, that, you know, social change is possible. I think sometimes, you know, some current social issues that seem, it's untenable that they'll ever change, but they can, like public opinion can shift very quickly, and I think that's quite inspiring.
For me, you can think a lot about the way that things have changed, and I think that is really evident in just just what you mentioned earlier, just really stuck with me with how the normalization amongst children, it's just like, it's just taken, it's not a question. It's not even anything to debate or discuss. It's just what is now, which is great.
And I think for me, just what I'd like kind of say to just anyone who's kind of growing up, or if anyone is kind of questioning or struggling, you know, it's if you want that white wedding, you can have it no matter what you are, no matter who you find attractive, no matter who you love, you can have that fairy tale if that's what you want. And it's knowing that that is open to anyone and everyone, I think, is just really special.
Thanks everyone for such an interesting and sort of emotional discussion. I wasn't expecting it to feel that emotional, but it really does. So thank you all for sharing, and hopefully you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, and you can listen to other podcasts from Ipsos on the Ipsos UK podcast channel. So please do follow us. Thank you.